Hello, everyone. My name is Jessica Weider, and I work with EPA's Radiation Protection Program. I want to thank you all for taking the time to join us today. I'm going to be your moderator for today's webinar. So you'll see if you're in the webinar itself that you can send messages to me if you have any questions throughout, and I'll be paying attention, and I'll try and address them as quickly as possible. I have Brian Littleton, also from EPA's Radiation Protection Program, here with me. Brian is going to give us a presentation on the advance notice of proposed rulemaking for EPA's Environmental Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations, or what we call the ANPR for short. I just want to be clear right up front, EPA is not proposing any changes to the standards at this time. We have not made any decisions. We are issuing this ANPR to get public input as we evaluate whether or not the standards need to be updated. So we're having this webinar today to provide you information specifically on the ANPR and release limits. And at the end of the presentation, Brian's going to tell you how you can submit comments to the docket. To be clear, this webinar is not a means of submitting comments. Comments on the ANPR must be submitted in writing to the docket in order to be considered. So before we get started, we have a lot of people on the line today, and I think you can hear them still chiming in. So I'm going to lay out some ground rules for you for the webinar. So we're going to keep the phone lines on mute so that everyone can hear the presentations without distraction. Brian's going to give his presentation, and at the end, he is going to answer your questions. So we're going to ask you to submit questions through the webinar software. If you look at your screen, at the bottom of the screen, you'll see a chat box. Please feel free to include your questions in this box. So even though we're answering questions at the very end of the presentation, please feel free to enter your questions throughout the webinar, and I will track them and I will ask them to Brian at the very end. And we ask that only questions be related, that only questions related to the standards in ANPR be entered. So I'm sure you know this, but we'll not allow any entries that use bad language or threatening or defamatory language or that endorse particular services or products. So with that disclaimer, I will pass you over to Brian, who will provide you with some background on EPA's Environmental Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations and Release Limits. And so, Brian, I'm going to pass this over to you.
Thank you, Jessica. My name is Brian Littleton. I'm the project lead for EPA's Radiation Protection Division, under which is the agency's Office of Air and Radiation. The advance notice of proposed rulemaking was published in the Federal Register on February 4th of 2014, and the public comment period for this ANPR will be open until June 4th of 2014. In this webinar, we're discussing the issues related to the radionuclide release limits contained in 40 CFR Part 190. We are not here today to take comments. Comments must be submitted in writing. We're here today to help you prepare your comments by discussing some of the issues around the radionuclide release limits and to give you a chance to hear each other's thoughts and questions on this issue. Just a reminder that under the Atomic Energy Act, EPA developed this standard. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually implements or enforces this standard at nuclear fuel cycle facilities. Now let's get started. This is slide 4 that we're on now. Slide 4 has the outline for today's presentation. In this presentation, we will discuss some general background on the radionuclide release limits found in 40 CFR Part 190.10b. We will discuss the guiding assumptions for the existing standards. Then we will talk about why we are considering revising these limits. We will discuss some of the agency's preliminary options for consideration on the radionuclide release limits. Then we will restate the questions that we are soliciting public input on. Finally, we will provide a summary of this presentation, followed by a question and answer period. We'll close by having an opportunity for public discussion of this issue. Now, if we move on to the next slide. Slide number 5 has some of the background for this issue. 40 CFR 190 contains two main radiation protection provisions. a dose standard under 40 CFR 190.10A, and a radionuclide release limits established under 40 CFR Part 190.10B that set annual limits on the total quantities of radioactivity entering the environment for certain radionuclides. This issue focuses on the radionuclide release limits that are found under 40 CFR 190.10B, or they are also known as the radionuclide release caps. This portion of the standard sets caps for the following radionuclides: 50,000 curies for krypton 85, and this is per gigawatt of electricity produced in any given year; 5 millicuries of iodine 129 per gigawatt of electricity produced in any given year; and 0.5 or half a millicurie of combined plutonium 239 and other alpha emitters with half-lives great exceeding 1 year. And again, this is per a gigawatt of electricity produced in any given year. The limits apply to the total amount of these releases, of these radionuclides released from the nuclear power operations nationally in a given year. So that's why they're called a cap. It's a cap on the industry. These limits can also be viewed as national goals that are not to be exceeded. Okay, if we move to the next slide, slide number 6. In the development of this portion of the standard, the agency focused on the uranium fuel cycle, citing, and I'm quoting from the final environmental statement that was produced in support of the rule initially, in the U.S., early development focused on light water-cooled nuclear reactors using uranium-235 as fuel for the generation of electricity, end quote. This statement is from the final environmental statement, again, which served as the technical support document for the standard. The agency conveniently divided the uranium fuel cycle into three parts. The first part is those processes conducted to develop the uranium fuel. The second part is the fission reaction, which is at the nuclear power plants. And the third portion is spent fuel reprocessing processes that are conducted at the tail end. Fuel reprocessing plants were considered as the final part of the uranium fuel cycle, with unused portions of uranium-235 and reactor-produced plutonium-239 being reintroduced into the feed. Additionally, excerpts from the 1976 final environmental statement indicate the agency's rationale in mandating this second set of environmental standards found in 40 CFR 190.10B. The radionuclide release limits state, quote, in support of the radionuclide release limits, we state that finally, although fuel reprocessing plants are few in number, they represent the largest single potential source of environmental contamination in the fuel cycle, since it is at this point that the fuel cladding is broken up and all remaining fission and activation products become available for potential release to the environment, end quote. The agency determined in the development of 40 CFR Part 190 that these standards would be important in reducing the environmental dose commitments for persistent radiological contaminants, and we still consider this a desirable goal. Let's move to the next slide. Slide number 7 specifically talks about the derivation of the radionuclide release limits found in 40 CFR 190.10B. In developing the radionuclide cap limits that the agency considered three factors. The first is projections based on modeling of source terms. The second is measurements from existing facilities. And the third was industry anticipated performance. However, after considering all three of these factors, the agency found that the most complete set of data was derived from model-based projections. This was because at the time they did not have extensive measurements on effluent releases from all of the uranium fuel cycle facilities to rely on. The downside with relying on projections from modeling was the potential for some of these projections to be off. These projections included an anticipation of 300,000 megawatts of nuclear energy generated annually by the year 2000. It also included nuclear energy growth from 8% of the nation's energy mix back around the 1970s to approximately 40 to 60% of the nation's energy mix at around the year 2000. And one last assumption that was believed to be correct was spent nuclear fuel reprocessing would be conducted throughout the U.S. Now, to put some of these projections in perspective, we are currently operating in the range of about 100,000 megawatts of nuclear energy produced per year, which amounts to approximately 20% of the nation's energy mix. And as stated earlier, we are not processing spent nuclear fuel. We need to acknowledge that the agency realized that when developing projections for nuclear energy, it was better to err on the side of conservatism, or in other words, it's better to overestimate emissions. Let's move on to the next slide. Slide 8 discusses those radionuclides that the agency considered long-lived or persistent radiological contaminants associated with nuclear power generation. When developing the radionuclide release limits, the agency considered potential limits for tritium, carbon-14, krypton-85, iodine-129, and plutonium-239 and other alpha emitters. However, the agency found that no effective control technologies existed for tritium and carbon-14, and thus these contaminants were dropped from final consideration for establishing limits in this section. We move to slide number 9. So why consider revising this standard? The agency developed the existing standard under the assumption that the U.S. commercial reprocessing in the U.S., commercial reprocessing would be available. However, for policy and economic reasons, reprocessing never achieved the expected scale, and no commercial reprocessing plants are currently operating in the U.S. Since there is no commercial reprocessing, the limits of krypton and iodine are rarely approached. This is because it is the operation of breaking up the fuel cladding that allows for the fission products to be released from the spent fuel matrix and made available to the environment. However, the recently completed President's Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future discussed the role that reprocessing of spent nuclear fuel could play if there does not exist disposal for these wastes. While not endorsing spent nuclear fuel reprocessing, the BRC stated that one or more disposal facilities are needed even if full recycle technologies are eventually developed and adopted. If the nation were to pursue commercial reprocessing in some form and we were near or exceeded the radionuclide release limits, then there would be a need to be some mechanism in place to reduce releases. Additional guidance may need to be developed in order to partition the releases of the contaminant that exceeded the limit so that reductions could be attributed to various facilities. Let's move on to slide number 10. Given this, there are several options under consideration for this provision of the regulation. These options include, number 1, eliminate this provision of the regulation and rely on other limits, either the dose or risk limits, to produce protection of public health and the environment. Number 2, use the concept from the existing standards of limiting the environmental burden of long-lived radionuclides in the biosphere as a guide and calculate equivalent standards that could apply outside individual facilities. An example, reprocessing plants. Or number 3, use another regulatory option that the agency has not currently formulated as the basis of a replacement regulatory provision. And that's where we would like input from the public specifically. We move on to slide number 11. Given these issues regarding the radionuclide release limits, the agency is seeking comment on the following questions. Number 1, should the agency retain the concept of radionuclide-specific release limits to prevent the environmental buildup of long-lived radionuclides? What should the basis of these limits be? Number two, is it justifiable to apply limits on an industry-wide basis, and if so, can this be reasonably implemented? Would facility limits be more practicable? And number three, if release limits are used, are the radionuclides for which limits have been established in the existing standard still appropriate? And if not, which ones should be added or subtracted? Okay. Slide number 12 is a summary. In summary, EPA will be considering whether the radionuclide release limits stated under 40 CFR 190.10b should be retained in their current form, modified to be more implementable, or eliminated entirely. We are open to and will accept comments or recommendations on any other manner to limit environmental commitment of persistent radiological contaminants from uranium fuel cycle facilities. And if we go to slide number 13, this is the end of this short webinar. It's time to summarize the ways to manners in which to present your comments. Statements can be submitted, should not be submitted during, or statements submitted during this webinar are not considered as official comments. Comments can be submitted by going to www.regulations.gov and following the directions, or submitting comments via email to a-n-r docket@epa.gov, or submitting mail to the EPA's docket center and quoting the proper docket, or hand-delivering your comments to the EPA Docket Center at 1301 Constitution Avenue in Northwest Washington, D.C., during normal work hours. Now we'll enter into the question and answer period of the webinar.
Great. I just want to remind folks, if you have questions, please put them in the chat box. If you'd like to do it a little more anonymously, you can feel free to message me personally. You've got my name. Again, my name is Jessica Weeder. You should see me under host. And you can send a message to me that way, a question to me that way. So I'm going to get started. Brian, we have a few questions. Now, the first one is, are nuclear power limits different from deep waste repository accidental release limits?
Yes, they are. These limits are different based upon, these limits apply to nuclear fuel cycle facilities as they operate. The other limits and What were those, Jessica, again?
The deep waste repository accidental release limits.
Yes, they are probably guided by a different statute, I would think, and they apply to under a different set of, concerns.
Brian, these are very specific to the uranium fuel cycle as opposed
yes.
to the deep waste repository.
That's correct.
Okay. The next question, you mentioned it on slide 8, and I think you mentioned it at least one or two other times in the later on in the presentation when you were talking about plutonium and other alpha emitters. Is there a list of those alpha emitters available somewhere that were considered?
What it says is plutonium-239 and other alpha emitters. What they're talking about there is primarily the actinide series and from the for those familiar with the chemistry of it, but they're from, I guess, actinide starts with, I don't have my chemical list here, but the actinide series and on up to the final chemical elements that are there.
All right. Regarding reprocessing specifically, would plutonium warhead reprocessing for commercial reactor fuel at Savannah River site be included within the scope of this rule?
Plutonium
warhead reprocessing for commercial reactor fuel.
If it were used for commercial fuel, then it would enter into the nuclear fuel cycle. And, yes, it would be regulated. But I'm not quite sure, because that is a that would be a new operation. I'm not quite sure that we've actually encountered that yet, but I realize that some of that could be coming up. But I guess the thing to do for that one is let me hold off on that and maybe provide another answer once I check with our legal folks.
That sounds good. And if there are some specific comments on that, that's something that would be interesting to put into the docket if you have thoughts on that. We'd appreciate it. Great. Our next question is, what is the maximum release per GW electricity produced registered so far by any of the nuclear power plants in the U.S., if you have data for comparison? So what's the maximum release per gigawatt electricity produced registered so far?
Well, again, this goes back to a statement that I made at the beginning of the webinar. The agency had developed these standards. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission actually enforces or implements these standards. So they would have that data. The data is available, although I'm not necessarily sure that it's available on a per-facility-type basis because, again, our standard is not on a per-facility-type basis. It's a cap for the industry. So I'm not sure if they have that information in that form. But the data is available in some form or fashion from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
And I'm going to ask the next question, but I actually think you may have answered it a little bit in this response. Can you explain a bit more about whether uranium fuel production facilities, i.e. processing mills, enrichment, fabrication, are affected by Part 190 requirements, and how are their radioactive releases regulated?
The facilities, uranium mills, as well as a uranium conversion, fuel fabrication. These facilities are part of the uranium fuel cycle. They are covered by our standard. Now, as a matter of process, because they're covered by our standard, they have to meet our limits. So hopefully that's an answer to that question.
Moving on, the next question is, has the EPA considered aligning their releases with the limits the NR, which, sorry, let me reread that. Has the EPA considered aligning their release limits with the NRC's release limits in 10 CFR 20?
There are certain things regarding the release limits in 10 CFR 20 that both our agency, as part of the Advanced Notice of Proposed Rulemaking view, is working on as well as I'm sure the NRC is working on as far as their consideration of updating the 10 CFR 20. And these are looking at, putting our limits in an effective dose type of a standard. So we're both considering those, but our releases are separate. They have to be enforced. And they are enforced by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as well as any limits that the NRC develops as well.
Brian, we got a question via email. The question is, how will EPA account for what has already been released? Is EPA going to use radionuclide measurements in tree rings, biological markers in humans and animals, et cetera, to establish what is already contaminating our environment?
Well, our limits are on an annual basis. So if we have not exceeded these limits for the year, then we generally move to the next year. You know, so I would tend to think that probably the Nuclear Regulatory Commission may have a better view on how they would look at past releases. But generally, you have to comply with the annual limits. That's what this standard is, an annual limit, either a release limit or a dose limit, and then you have to comply with that aspect.
We've had some people who've had trouble accessing the Adobe Connect. They're following on the telephone and looking at the slides. If you have any questions, please email them to me, Nesky, N-E-S-K-Y, Tony, T-O-N-Y, at EPA.gov.
I think there may be a few more questions. I'm waiting for them online. In the meantime, I'm going to write in Tony's email address. I guess if you're on the webinar, you already have access to send us questions. So, never mind. All right, great. We have another question here. Do the existing annual limits incorporate removal mechanisms such as radioactive decay, what defines persistent radionuclide? So there are two different questions. The first one, let's start with the first one. Do the existing limits incorporate removal mechanisms such as radioactive decay?
Well, decay is taken into account when these, I guess, limits are complied with by industry. They do take into account decay for some of these short-lived radionuclides. This would actually be more directed towards the dose limits that are part of 190.10A, as opposed to the long-lived radionuclides that are part of the 190.10B, which are part of today's discussion. So they are accounted for in that manner.
Neil, the second part of that question is, what defines a persistent radionuclide?
Well, these are, as the agency developed its environmental statement and looked at those radionuclides that were produced by the uranium fuel cycle facility, we considered those radionuclides which have either very long-lived half-lives, and there are some, especially any of the actinides, the plutonium-239 and the uraniums, that are thousands of years. So those would be considered persistent or long-lived radionuclides. The other ones would be any radionuclides which were unreactive in the environment. So there's some of these that are inert chemicals, and as such, they are very unreactive in the environment, so they stay around in the environment for a long time. So that's what the agency has defined as persistent, and this is defined as persistent or long-lived radionuclides. We did take a look at defining that when we developed the final environmental statement that was published in 1976. And that is available on our webpage. And so you can go back and take a look at how we've defined it there for a more precise definition.
Okay, thanks, Brian. We have a question that's come in over email for Tony. Tony?
We got a question over email. Is there a way to move towards a zero release goal?
I don't think, you know, when I had the general webinar, I think we talked about, you know, is it the agency's purpose to move towards zero release? We would like to see releases as low as possible. But I guess if the comment is indicating, are we trying to get rid of the nuclear industry, that's not the agency's goal. Our agency is to set protective limits to the public and the environment. So that's what our goal is. Not necessarily to eliminate all radiation, because I don't think that that's really feasible. But
I think, again, if you have comments on the matter, this is an opportunity to put your comments into the docket for official consideration. I just want to stress again that the comments that are made here are for discussion purposes, and that to be actually considered, they need to be taken into the docket. We have another question for you. Does this proposed rule apply to nuclear reactors on ships or just land-based power generating facilities?
A very interesting question. I think for that question, I'd like to check with our legal folks. It was designed for the nuclear facilities, and as such, I don't believe a ship would meet the definition of a fuel cycle facility. But I would have to kind of check on that and get back to you. That's one I don't want to answer right now.
Okay, Tony, do we have the participants' email addresses?
Yes, we do.
Okay, excellent. Garrett, I'll get back to you on that. We have another question that's come in. Providing that the NRC is enforcing the limits, why not accept effluent limits already established by NRC and eliminate this section from the standard?
That sounds like a comment, and we're willing to accept that comment, but understand that the Atomic Energy Act kind of set out rules and responsibilities for the development of the standard and the actual enforcement of the standard, and they decided that the agency was to develop a standard applying to the uranium fuel cycle, and that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission would implement that.
Great. I think we are waiting for another comment or two. Tony, do we have anything else?
We most certainly do.
Excellent.
All right, 1 second here. What reference does the EPA use for estimating risk from low-level ionizing radiation? BEER-7?
We do use BEER-7 for this, but I'm not sure. That comment sounds like it's getting at something a little deeper. For this standard, we used, I guess, beer one or two, if I remember correctly. And so if we were to revise the standard, we would definitely update it to use the most current beer seven type of estimates, as well as the EPA's Blue Book estimates on radiogenic cancer risk.
And this is also, I think, an opportunity because we asked some questions on updating based on current science. If there are some thoughts or suggestions on what should be used, this is another opportunity for providing information into the docket. Tony, did you have another question?
Yes, we have a number of questions that have been submitted by email. Next question submitted by email, does the EPA have any publicly available lists which identify each radionuclide emitted in each phase of the nuclear cycle and specifies the allowable amount of each isotope?
I would say the answer to that question is yes. And I would go back to the final environmental statement and the supporting documents that the agency developed when we initially developed the regulation. There, what we've done systematically is we've defined each of the processes from the uranium fuel cycle and then talked about potential releases from each of these processes. And then we've gone on to try to quantify them before we actually determine how much of these radionuclides would be present in the environment under certain circumstances. So the answer to that question would be yes, and it's available in the final environmental statement that the agency published in 1976.
I'll take one. We have another question over here. Should the EPA move forward with the rulemaking, will they take into account any applicable international standards and regulations in place in countries already reprocessing nuclear fuel for the purpose of making the rule applicable to the USA? If not, why not?
We don't know how we are going to account for that. We know that information is out there, that data is out there. We do have access to that data. So I'm sure that it won't be missed if we were to move forward with revising the standard. I'm sure that we would take a look at it. But we really have not, I guess, kind of crossed that bridge yet as far as how we're going to revise the standard, because we're still determining if we should move forward or not.
We actually have a comment here suggesting that if people have questions kind of on the current regulation and how it was developed, that they take a look at the Sandia report that outlines the basis for the current regulation.
Sandia report came out, I believe, sometime around 2005, and if the commenter has any more specific information about that report, I've seen it. I don't have access to it right now. We'd appreciate it if they submitted that and then made it available so that the public could have that information as well.
Okay, great. I've got one more question over here. How would commercial spent nuclear fuel that DOE owns, I guess let me split this into two questions. The first one is, how would the commercial spent nuclear fuel that DOE owns be affected by the rulemaking?
This applies to,
For example, the Fermi one fast reactor.
Okay. I think this question is something that I guess I don't feel comfortable answering without a little bit more information from our legal group.
Okay.
If they could submit this question or comment, then we will respond to it once we have a chance to talk with our
counsel. The second part of that question, and this you may have the same response, is what effect would the rulemaking have on DOE's plans to reprocess? I guess we'll be affected by the potential rulemaking.
Sounds like the same question.
Yeah.
We'll have to get back on that issue.
Okay, great. Tony?
Yes, we're still getting questions via email. Thank you very much. Next question. How will EPA apply ALARA in setting new release limits?
ALARA is not an agency concept. It's a concept that the NRC uses in their regulatory program. So I think that question is better addressed to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's not, and to be quite clear, it's not a construct of this standard.
Okay, another question from email. In reprocessing, I believe it's a question about carbon-14 and tritium, which you referred to. I believe that carbon-14 is at least easy. I believe that carbon-14 at least is easily removed in a caustic rinse and precipitated with calcium. Therefore, why did the speaker indicate that there was no effective removal technique? Is the key word effective? Also, tritium can be removed on zeolite. So the same question with respect to tritium.
I think that the question, the commenter kind of answered their own question. It has to do with can it actually be implemented on the scale needed to provide the reductions necessary to meet any limits that are established, that would be established for either of those two chemicals. And the answer to that question is yes, there are techniques to remediate both carbon-14 and tritium, but on the scale that they need to be done in order to meet some sort of effective reduction, they were not... The agency determined that it was not available at that time, we would have to take a look at it, an additional look at it under today's, standards and technologies to determine if it's available now.
Okay, some more questions from email. Where do I find the documents that EPA uses to calculate the annual dose to me, whomever the final dose receptor is? So who is that?
Okay.
Where do I find the documents that EPA uses to calculate the annual dose to the final receptor?
Well, the NRC actually does the implementation of this standard. And actually the doses are submitted by industry to the NRC, and the NRC reviews, confirms, and assures that they are in compliance with the release limits. So that's a Nuclear Regulatory Commission function and not necessarily an agency function.
Another question. You talked about meeting an annual standard. So is it assumed that all previous years are no longer causing any dose to the N receptor after the year it was counted? So in other words, your standard does not factor cumulative radioactivity?
The standards apply on an annual basis. Now, they look at, I guess, the accumulation specifically for 190.10B radionuclides. They had a look of over 30 years, the operating life of a facility, which, based upon our background documents, was 30 years back then. And they said, what could potentially accumulate over those years? And then they backed out and set an annual limit to prevent that type of an accumulation. But the limits, again, are annual limits. They're not, they're annual limits on these long-lived radionuclides. But they're, and so they can't really be, I feel like the commenter is mixing and matching there. So it's a little bit of an odd bag, the question is. I'm not sure if I really answered that question effectively.
Yeah, we have a few more questions. Will releases be measured by the facility, or will it be determined by an independent group?
The releases are measured by the facility and submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has the authority to enforce and implement these standards. So.
We've got one over here. Some proposed reactors design the reactor running for decades without refueling and the spent fuel remaining in the reactor indefinitely. Does EPA envision separate standards for reactors that don't have a fuel cycle, but rather a fuel line?
I believe that we'll accept that comment. That comment would apply more towards new technologies, and it would be something that we would consider as if this case were to occur. And I'm familiar with some of the new technologies that are out there. It could occur. Should the agency do anything as far as develop a standard that would apply to that specific case? And that's a good comment. So we'll take comments on that.
So please, if you have comments or thoughts on that, submit them to the docket.
Question from email. Does EPA agree with Beer 7 that the linear no threshold model is the best model for estimating risk at low dose?
Yes, we do. The agency still supports the linear no threshold model. Let me say about that.
Yes, more time.
Oh, yes,
please.
If the new methodology for release limits are used in the standard, will there be an effort to incorporate this methodology into the CAP 88 code so that dose to the maximum affected individual can be calculated?
That's something that we'll have to consider. I think the agency will take comment on that. You know, that's an issue that's fair game for consideration.
Okay, at this point, folks, we're gonna address the questions we've received so far, we're gonna cut it off at this point. You know, the presentation's available online. No, we're not. We're gonna stay online and answer the questions we've received up to this point. So, Tony, I know you have a few more, and I've got one over here.
Okay. Next question from email: doesn't collected dose still have an important role in determining whether technologies designed to limit releases are cost beneficial?
Yes, it does. I would say consider our write-up in the advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. We do think there is a role for it. The question that most people have is, does it have a role in developing, I guess, portions of the standard? And that's a question that we're taking comment on.
Next question. Is the goal to allow the whole fuel chain to release up to the amount of radiation that is calculated to cause less than or equal to EPA's allowable risk or dose?
Okay, and that the question is a little ambiguous. It's like the goal. It depends on whose goal it is. Our goal is to set an environmental standard that sufficiently protects the public from the downside of creating nuclear energy. So that's what our goal is. I'm not sure, quite sure. How that, I guess, how that fits that question.
And the last one I've received, ALERA has always been a basic tenet of the health physics profession. Since when did EPA abandon the basic concept in developing standards?
We've never used ALERA in developing our standards. Again, it's not something that's an agency, something that the agency has used in the development of our standards. It's a nuclear regulatory concept. I think it's a very good concept, but it's just not part of how the agency goes about developing our standards. So.
For those of you who are on the webinar, there have been two recommendations for documents to go look at. Billy has provided information on where to find the Sandia National Lab report that he referenced. And Adam provided some information on going to nrc.gov to find the annual effluent reports and the annual REMP reports containing environmental sampling results. So those are available there for your information. And I think that on that note, I... I think I would like to thank everybody, unless anybody has anything else. If you have something that you would like to, there's a little, at the top of your screen, there's like a little hand raise button. So feel free.
One.
Huh? Sounds like some folks are signing off, so... in the meantime, I would like to thank everybody for joining us. Tony?
Thank you all for joining us. I know a number of you participating today had trouble accessing Adobe Connect. I'm sorry to hear that. A lot of you sent me screenshots with your error messages or gave me the error messages. Thank you very much. I'll be forwarding that to our IT department. But we are going to have a couple more webinars in the future, and we will always make the slides available in advance and give you a dial-in number and have someone taking questions by email so that if we continue to have troubles or it's just not convenient for you to use Adobe Connect, there will be this other method. And for those of you who used it today, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful, wonderful afternoon.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.